disabled people deserve a space to be sexual, we're still having the same conversations around access, around sexuality. Or like in 2024, disabled sex should be commonplace. It shouldn't be something we're so afraid to navigate.
My name is Abby, and I'm the voice behind the Evolving Love Project. In this podcast, my husband and I deep dive into the topics of non-monogamy and polyamory, drawing from our experiences of being consensually non-monogamous for almost a decade.
My name is Liam. Whether you're monogamous, polyamorous, curious, or anything in between, we invite you to join us for this conversation.
Let's begin.
Andrew Gerza is an award-winning disability awareness consultant whose written work has been featured on BBC, CBC, Daily Extra, Gay Times UK, and Huffington Post. As a host, Andrew presents the award-winning Disability After Dark, which shines a light on disability stories and sexuality. He was nominated for a Canadian Podcast Award, a Queerty Award, and was chosen as an honoree at the 2020 Webby Awards.
Andrew has appeared on Dan Savage's Savage Love and Cameron Esposito's Query. He has spoken all over the world on sex, disability, and what it means to be queer and disabled. Andrew is also the creator of the viral hashtag DisabledPeopleAreHot. You can find out more about Andrew by going to www.andrewgerza.com. This conversation covers a lot of ground, and listeners will fall in love with Andrew's honesty, grace, intellect, and disarmingly wicked sense of humour.
After this conversation, Andrew is one of our favourite people, and we know by the end of this episode, he will be one of yours too. So without further ado, we bring to you our conversation with the wonderful Andrew Gerza. So Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the Evolving Love podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. I know it's early for you folks over there in Australia. It's early morning. Wow, I'm so sorry to wake you up.
No, this is the perfect way to rise.
Definitely worth it.
Wow, there's so many innuendos there already. I don't know where to go.
There's going to be a lot flowing in this conversation, I feel like. But I wanted to start this conversation by talking about, I heard you reference this in a podcast that I was listening to in preparation for this, but I'd love to start on what your Grindr names. You've had quite a few Grindr names and they are absolutely brilliant. So could you share us some of your hits?
I love that as the first question. Wow. my favorite one, the one that I have right now on Grindr and Scruff, and they're basically the same thing, Thick Dick Crip is what I have right now. And then sometimes it's Cerebral Ballsy because it's funny.
Oh my God.
And then sometimes it's, what else have I done? I just had Disabled Dick Smith the other day. I thought that was funny. Bear in a Chair. Just playing with the fact that I'm very, very disabled and not letting whoever clicks on my profile forget that or overlook that, because if they're going to spend, like, I'm not serious about my Grindr stuff, but I think if we're on a hookup app, that's what I want to do too. And you need to be fully primed with who you're getting. And so if I can make you laugh about the fact that I'm disabled, laugh with me or at me, whatever you want. Like, I'd rather you be laughing than be afraid of it. So I think playing with that and being really honest with that is a way to, especially because the community that I look to for sex is queer men, and they tend to be pretty ableist, among other things they are. So I try to, you know, I'm very upfront about that, and if I can do it with humor, that's always better.
And do you feel like there's a lot of, like, reclamation in that as well? Like, I feel like you're reclaiming a lot of words that would be a little bit, you know, no-go areas in the disability space.
Yeah, I mean, people don't like when I use queer sometimes in the queer space, weirdly enough, but for me, it's reclamation. People also don't like that I use queer cripple together, because I'm like, cripple is a really dark word, has a really dark history. Mm-hmm. I know that, and I'm using it for myself. I found, though, you know, other terms that I've used, I started referring to myself as severely disabled, and that I found people in the disability community have been less than okay with me using that. I'm like, well, that's what I'm describing myself. Am I not allowed to use the terms that I want to? So I feel like we have a lot of work to do around language, But when I think about the language that's been kind of pitted against disabled folks, now I listen to, instead of immediately calling you out for saying words like handicapped or special needs or whatever it is, I listen to how they're saying it. Are they saying it because that's what they genuinely thought you wanted them to say? Or are they saying it with some sort of edge to their voice? And there's no edge there. Like, what value do I have in screaming at you if you've said it wrong? If you're trying to learn, if I scream at you, especially in a sexy context, if you say something that I don't like, if I want to get down with you and I yell at you, we're probably not going to fuck. So I probably shouldn't yell at you. So I try to like remember that, you know, learning about disability and learning about one disabled person means you learned about one disabled person. And so another disabled person might say, I don't want you to use cripple. But for me, it's a way of reclamation and a way of playing with language in a fun way. That's like, why don't we look at it this way?
Do you find that you have that's been a process to get to that point? Have you always felt that sense of grace when someone comes at you with some kind of strange terminology or they might misspeak, even if it's accidentally?
Oh, no. I've had moments of complete disgrace where I've been really loud and really angry and really like rah, rah, rah. Because I think in our social media silos that we live in today, if I said you did an ableist thing and I put that on the internet as like a post, I would get a bunch of echo chambery people being like, yeah, you're right. Good for you. And so like, that's nice. Thank you for that little pat on the back. But like, are we learning? Are we teaching anything? Or are we just yelling at each other in silos? So I had a period in my activism where I would be really angry with a bunch of, you know, people saying ableist things and everybody was an ableist and, oh my God, how ableist are you? And like that worked for a while. But then I got really tired of it. I was like, I want people to learn. I want them to be friendly. I don't want to scream at them. I'd much rather be your friend. And so if I can, for me personally, and another disabled person might say, fuck that. I want to be angry. That's fine. You have a right to be angry. I just am like, the anger didn't get me anywhere. I'd much rather be happy, especially in like sexy context. I'd much rather enjoy myself.
How did you come about into your, like, what was it like for you coming into your sexuality as a queer man, you know, with a disability? I have so many questions for you. I'm interested in your relationship with your parents, your own sexual education. Like, what does sexual self-discovery look like for you?
Oh, that's a big one. How many hours do we have here? Well, I realized that I was gay. I realized that I was queer when I was about 4 years old. Because I had watched, do you remember the old 70s Robin Hood with the fox as Robin Hood?
Yes.
The British guy who was Robin Hood. I fell in love with that voice. And I was like, I don't know what's happening here, but that man talking to me through a fox is making me feel something. And I didn't know what it was, obviously, because I was like 4. But I distinctly remember being like, oh, something's different here. This is not what I'm supposed to be feeling. What's going on? And so then, from little moments like that, and then when I was, you know, a preteen, like realizing like, oh, I'm having fantasies about boys in a completely different way than the other kids. What is this? And my family was always very supportive because I have relatives who are queer. My aunt is queer. So queerness has been in my family for, you know, as long as I've been here. So it was not really a shock. My mom lived in, actually lived in Sydney in the 70s and was around a bunch of gay men and did all that stuff. And so like she was very open. So when I came out at 16, you know, almost 25 years ago this month, weird, gross. I was afraid because there were no pamphlets in my high school that were like, oh, you're gay and disabled? Here's what you do. There was all, like, and I was watching vintage Queer as Folk from the early 2000s and being like, oh, this is the kind of queerness that I want. This. I want to go to a club and meet somebody who is definitely maybe almost a sexual predator and go home with it. That's what I want. And so I wanted this idea of that. But there was no one being like, oh, you're disabled and need help with everything? How do you be queer? And so, and all of the queer media 25 years ago was, oh, you're queer? We're kicking you out of your house. You can't stay here. Queerness is wrong. It was way less evolved, which is weird because it was only 2000, but it was way less evolved than it is now. So I had these like dark fantasies of my mom's going to kick me out. And I remember telling her, and when I told her I was queer, well, I said, actually, I'm gay. The very first thing she said was,
Oh,
it's fine. It's fine. You know, she was very, very loving and very supportive, and then said, do you think Brad Pitt's hot? And I was like, of course I think. Of course I think Brad Pitt's attractive. And so we sat down, and she made me honey and yogurt, and I'll never forget it because it was my comfort food at the time. And I had a big cry, and she had a big cry, and then she rented Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and said, if you want to be these kind of gay men, like, this is for you. And at the time, I was like, no, this is not me. And so, but she said to me something that I'll never forget in that coming out moment of like, just steel yourself, because gay men are not going to know how to deal with you, are not going to know how to manage your disability. And again, because I was 16 at the time, I thought I knew everything. And I thought I was like, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. It'll be fine, whatever. But she was right, because when I went to college and I started going to queer events and trying to meet guys and going online and trying to find, okay, I'm gay. How do I like operationalize this thing that I am now? And I realized very quickly, gay men didn't know how to navigate me. I would go to bars and guys wouldn't talk to me. I would go to gay. I would go online and guys wouldn't approach me. I immediately felt a lot of backlash. And it just was, it was really hard. I mean, I am going to be 40 in a month. And I've only been on a handful of dates with guys. I predominantly use sex work to have my needs met. But all of those experiences made me realize that we have so much ableism in queer spaces that it's hard to know the kind of sexuality that I want to experience and know the kind of queer person that I would be were there no barriers, and then having no access to that. So it's a very lonely place to be, because I know the kind of queer sex that I want to have. I know the kind of queer relationships that I want to have, but I also know the people that I want to have them with are not ready to handle the fact that I'm disabled, and especially that I am as disabled as I am. So for those listening, I have spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy, which means I can't walk. I use a power chair, and I have somebody basically with me like 5 hours of the day to make sure that I go to the bathroom, that I have a shower, that I get up, that I, you know, clean my body. But I'm always with somebody doing that. So many queer men are, and I'll be blunt about this, they're selfish. They don't realize that, like, they don't, because many of them are alone and childless, they're allowed to be a little bit selfish. So they don't think about, oh, what if somebody that I'm with needs something or needs support or wants help? And so many of the hookups that I had when I was in college were just me trying to navigate with another person, are they okay with my disability? So that's a long way of being like, queerness has been really hard for me as a disabled person, because queer spaces are not accessible. And worse than that, the attitudes within queer spaces are not accessible. And so, like, it's a shame. There's so much racism, transphobia, misogyny, and ableism within those spaces that those spaces are exhausting to me. Like, I don't do queer spaces. I'd rather spend a couple $1,000s on my favorite sex worker and get my needs met exactly than venture out to go date somebody. That sounds horrible. I don't want to do that.
Do you find that in those initial explorations, that the process of talking to people, it was almost like they didn't actually understand kind of what you were going through? And once you started talking through and communicating, was the importance of communication, obviously that would just become so paramount in especially navigating those initial kind of conversations with people about, you know, your disability and how actually hookups would actually take place.
Yeah, the communication part is very important and was in those early years too. But when you're young like that, sometimes, disabled or not, you don't want to communicate. I don't want to walk you through all the things I need. I want to fuck you. And I would like to shut up and stop talking about my needs and actually do them. And so I learned that communication can be sexy, but I went through a period, and sometimes I still do, where I'm like, I don't want to talk to you, which is why I enjoy working with sex workers who know my needs, because I can say, you know what, for this session, come in and don't speak lots, do the things, and then like that's what I want, because sometimes that communication, to put the burden of that all on me, is consistently unsexy for me and unfun, and it gets really, if you spend the first hour of your hookup just laying out your needs, like, yes, that's important, and I think everyone should do that regardless of disability, but if you do that, sometimes you're like, this is a lot, I just want to do the thing. Like, the chemistry is gone because I'm giving you, like, the chemistry is not there because I'm giving you, like, a workbook on how to fuck me, and that's not fun anymore.
Yeah, it becomes work for you. Like, you're educating and you're trying to, like, have this, like, beautiful erotic space and, like, try and, like, get into that sexy zone, and instead you're, like, I imagine, you know, making sure that they're comfortable with your ad. And
oh,
like,
yeah, yeah. A lot of my sexuality, it's padding them, making sure they're all right, making sure they're comfortable, making sure that my body isn't, you know, scaring them, making sure that we can do things a certain way, even if my body can't move a certain way. So it's very, there's a lot of mental gymnastics. Even when I'm in a space with somebody that I'm comfortable with, I'm still waiting for them to be like, oh, you're very disabled, I should go home now.
Also thinking about like the preparation for a date or something like that. It's like, you know, how does that look for you as far as like being with, you know, your carer, like preparing you? You would have to have like a really good, you know, open relationship with a carer if you're like preparing for sex. And I feel like, are many carers sort of across that?
No, unfortunately, a lot of carers come from different socioeconomic backgrounds and different religious backgrounds, which is great. But also when you're dealing with queerness and sexuality, sometimes that can be like a rubbing against point of like, how do you really talk about that? So a lot of them aren't great, and you really have to cultivate a relationship with your carers that is really friendly and really upfront. So I'm very clearly queer with them, and I make a point of like, okay, so I'm gonna be fucking dude sometimes. I don't say it like that, but I say like I'm gonna be having a sexuality, and I might need you for this. Like, I've had care workers that I trust help me, you know, with sex toys. I've had care workers that I trust, you know, wash my genitals for pre-sex and after sex. And so like, but to get to that place where I'm comfortable with them has taken years sometimes to find someone that you're comfortable with. And I'll even arrange for hookups only when I know that like a preferred few are working at that moment, to be like, okay, you're on right now. Cool. I'm going to fuck on Thursday. Can you make sure that, you know, my balls are good?
Because there's also that tricky thing where someone could be a really great carer, but also not sex positive. So there's that kind of duality of like, you really have to carefully pick who you're going to have these conversations with, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. And there's no training for the individual. I mean, there's minimal training. There's training of like, yes, they're a person, they have sexuality, blah, blah. But there's no like, Andrew wants to fuck a dude. What do you need to do to help Andrew do that? Like, they don't get that kind of education because, you know, they're there to do a job, and sex is already taboo. And so, like, I can only imagine from their standpoint, you're there to work. You didn't expect to, like, be called up to Andrew's place to help him fuck some guy. Like, that's not what you don't think of that as a job to do. So I understand the tension there, but I think that, and that's why when I work with sex workers, I train them pretty good. Like, I will spend time with the worker that I'm sleeping with to be like, okay, I need your help to transfer me from my chair to the bed. I need your help to undress me. Like, I make it part of the play so that I don't have to rely on a third person who, again, maybe didn't come to work today, you know, expecting to watch Andrew screw somebody. So I think I think there needs to be more education around carers who are sex positive, because everyone deserves the right to experience sexuality. Some of us need more help, and no one is really talking about that.
Like, on the broader societal level, it feels like there isn't this awareness that people with disabilities are sexual beings, you know, that they, you know, have their desires. They have like your own sexual being. It's like,
they probably have more desire. Yeah. They probably have more desire because they've been so denied the chance to explore. Like, you know, I'm sure for the two of you, when you were in your teen years, like 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, what do? You explore, you meet people, you try different things. You have that time to explore. And a lot of us with disabilities, especially those of us who have severe disabilities who need more help, you're not in the formative years learning about your sexuality. You're probably having surgery. You're probably, you know, trying to survive. You're probably dealing with carers. You might be in and out of the hospital. Like, it's a completely different experience. So a lot of us, when we hit like 25, 30, we're like, oh, fuck, I haven't done all these things I want to do. And I have no education that's built for me on how to do them. What do I do?
I imagine it's almost like the sense of like infantilization of disabled people. It's like almost like some people would go, oh, well, you're disabled, so I can't possibly imagine a scenario where you might want to go and fuck some guys, or you might want to, you know, do something really kinky, because how could a disabled person, they're so fragile. It's almost like this absolute fragility that people kind of play into as this overarching narrative. Is that something that you've come across?
Yeah. I'll say, you know, I think some of us are fragile. Some of us do have disabilities where if you go too hard, you'll break a bone. But that's where we go back to the communication. Like, I can be dirty and dominant without touching you. I can tell you with my voice that I want you to, you know, stroke it harder, do this, use your mouth. Like, I can use my voice to be dominant. But I think this idea that fragility doesn't mean – this idea that fragility means no full stop – or that I don't consent to us doing something is silly, because of course I do. I mean, I think we also have to look at consent and disability from a much broader space than we do. We think of consent as no means no and yes means yes, and enthusiastic consent means yes. But how do you demonstrate enthusiastic consent when you can't move? Like, how do you do that? And so we need to start looking at it that way. And also, remembering, you know, to think of consent again, to think about, like, disabled women are assaulted at, you know, 7 to 8 to 9 times higher than non-disabled women. And so we have to look at, like, yes, disabled people are sexual beings, but we also need to find ways to ensure they're protected to explore their sexuality where they feel safe. And so that's why people feel this tension, because the stats are true. And our sexualities are also true. And so how do we bring that information to people while also saying these people are sexual beings too?
Yeah, I mean, far out. There needs to be so much more education around this. I'm thinking back to my, you know, sexual education growing up. I don't remember ever learning about sexual exploration for people with disabilities. Like, there was just no awareness whatsoever. And I'm just so interested, you know, I feel like in the education system, you know, of course every school is different, but gosh, there really just needs to be more education across the board. And that's why, Andrew, it's so amazing that you have your podcast and your work out there.
Thank you. Education is so, so important. When I was coming up in school in grade 9 and 10 and, you know, high school and all that stuff, I remember I watched the birthing video. And I was like, cool, I'm glad this woman is having a baby. That's great. But I want to fuck a dude. How do I do that?
Yeah, like, far out.
Where is this? And I wish that I had been given those tools. But also I wish that the students around me, the non-disabled students around me, had also been taught, hey, Johnny could be in a wheelchair. Johnny might want to put on a condom. Johnny might need help with that. I wish they'd been given that kind of education, because those non-disabled kids, they're going to become the non-disabled adults you see out in the world. And they're also going to, if they're lucky enough, they're going to become disabled themselves if they live long enough. And when they become disabled, they're going to want to have sex. They're going to want to mess around. They're going to want to still engage in their sexuality. Or they might run into a disabled person in their life that they're attracted to, and they might want to explore that. How do you do any of that if you don't have education around it? And then I think it does a disservice to both the non-disabled and disabled communities, because they both need that education. If they had that education, it would teach them how not to be an ableist douchebag at the bar when so-and-so in a wheelchair is trying to hit on you.
What have been your experiences when you're hitting on people at bars?
Oh, I don't go to bars anymore because they're trash. And most gay bars in Toronto are not accessible, and I'm sure in Australia it's a bit different because you guys don't have snow there, but it's generally not accessible here. There are a lot of stairs in the clubs here, but when I did go to the clubs in my college days, like, I would get in there and I'd have to go through the back of the club where the garbage is, and I didn't care because I was like, I'm 20, it's fine, the world, whatever. So I'd go in there and I would go to talk to guys and they wouldn't talk to me. They would look at me with like a sad pity face and not know what to do. And I'd be like, I just want to introduce myself. Like, I just want to say, hi, I'm Andrew. I think you're cute. Can I buy you a drink? Can we chat? Like, doing all the things you're taught to do and learning very quickly that your disability gets in the way of that. It's really disheartening because, and I remember like at one point I was waiting for an accessible cab out of the club and an older gentleman came up to me and said, if I give you $500 right now, would you suck my dick? And I was like, I'm 22. This feels weird. Like, no, I won't. I'm going home now. Mm-hmm. And like, just like the way that I would try so hard to meet people, like the desire to try was very intoxicating, but also very dangerous because I had wanted those experiences so much, I would put myself in situations that were not safe, that I should never have been doing. But I was like, I want somebody to fuck me. I'm going to try this, which, you know, when you're in your 20s, you think you're invincible. But when you're disabled and you think you're invincible, it's really unsafe. And so now looking back, I'm like, how did I get out of there unscathed? I'm very lucky that I'm okay. Because I did some really silly things, like, you know, going to meet a random guy at 3 a.m. who I didn't know. And then asking him to, like, carry me out of my wheelchair, bring me into his place. And, like, I don't know this guy from anybody. Assuming that I would be safe and, like, knowing that. And now looking back on it and knowing the rates of sexual assault that disabled people go through and knowing the abuse that we experience and thinking, how the fuck did I get out of there? Okay, like, I'm very, very lucky. And so I would never do it now. I'm glad that I tried it, but I'm also like, what were you doing?
I'm thinking about these, you know, these spaces for queer men, or, you know, when I think of like the gay scene or the queer scene and people exploring their sexuality, you know, you can often think about like nightclubs or sex parties, sex clubs, things like that. It's like, you know, as a person with a disability, it's like there'd be so much that would be involved for you to partake, you know, in an environment like that. I could only imagine how frustrating that must have been, because it's like if you would have gone to a space like that, like as a disabled person, it's like what would you need for that to be accessible? Like, you know, to have a caretaker there or, you know, someone to help to help navigate you around.
All of that, caretaker there, enough space for your wheelchair. If you're going to fuck, you need like a special lift, a hoist to make sure you're okay. You need like an accessible bed. You need somebody to take care of you. You need somebody to provide pre-care and aftercare. Like there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. And in 2015, I hosted a sex party for disabled folks.
Oh, amazing.
Please tell us all about it.
I hosted a sex party in Toronto called Deliciously Disabled. And we had people from all over the world come to this party, and it was for everybody, but it was designed around disabled bodies. And we had hoists and we had accessible beds and we had caretakers and we had, you know, safe spaces. And we had a guy do a striptease with me, and we had like, it was meant to be a sexual space, but nobody really had sex. We all just wanted a space to be free to explore that. But the amount of backlash that we got from doing that, we had somebody from your wonderful country, I can't remember who, some disc jockey in the morning call us up and say something like, oh, how do you guys have sex? Do you like bump your chairs together? And we were like,
oh my God. Oh,
fuck.
We were like, is this a serious interview? Because we're trying to do a serious, like we had Howard Stern emailing us saying, can we come film it as a joke? Can we like, you know, can we film you doing this? And we were like, no, we're not, it's not satire, like we're actually doing it. It's not something that you can make fun of. Like we had so much backlash doing it. I'll probably never do it again because it was so emotionally, I'm proud of it, but I'm also like, I'll never get over how hard that was to do and how many moving parts there were. And I didn't even have sex. I spent the whole night saying, hi, how are you? Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for being here. Like I probably won't do it again. But I'm very, very proud of that. I'm so proud we got to do it.
Wow.
Well, on behalf of that Australian dickhead disc jockey, I'd like to apologize because that is just disgraceful behavior. And this is what it's fascinating. You mentioned like being the host of the party, how you weren't actually able to enjoy it.
I didn't have sex. I was so busy making sure that it looked okay, making sure that everybody else was okay, making sure that, like, you know, everybody with a disability was greeted, making sure I was so busy doing that. I did not enjoy myself. I love that we had it, but then to receive, and also we had other disabled people who before and after the event said, how dare you do this? This is goes against like what we want. This is, you're a heathen, don't do it. And we were like, oh, wow, we're just trying to show that disabled people deserve a space to be sexual. And it's a shame that that was literally 10 years ago now, and we're still having the same conversations around access, around sexuality. Or like in 2024, disabled sex should be commonplace. It shouldn't be something we're so afraid to navigate.
Well, in Australia, in 2020, there was the big court ruling. In Australia, we have the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And so what happened with that was a lady, and I'm sure you know about this, but just for our listeners who might not know about it, a lady in her mid-40s with multiple sclerosis applied to have sex work included as part of her kind of insurance. And initially there was pushback, and she took it all the way to federal court, and the federal court ruled that she was actually, in fact, allowed to use the monies that she was getting as part of the insurance scheme for sex work, which is really incredible. And now, even though there is some gray area in some of the legal things, it's widely considered that disabled people in Australia can spend insurance on sex work, which is really incredible.
It's groundbreaking. Like, I wish that it was here.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because you're in Canada, in Toronto. What's the situation with sex work? When you're hiring a sex worker, you mentioned, you know, you do this. What's the process like for that?
It's very gray. I met them on a gay male escort site, and you don't say what you're doing, and you say you're spending time together. And if anybody asks you, you said you spend time together, and that's, you believe it at that, because all of us do it, but it's not legal, and you can't really... if anything happens between you and the sex worker, you can't really do anything because you're committing a crime. I don't see it that way. I see it as therapy, and I see it as something that's important. So I don't, like, I am pretty much like, really, I'm on disability assistance. And like, if they want to come for me because I advocate for disabled people to have access to sex work, come for me. Like, I'm not afraid of it, but it's technically a crime here. The sex worker would not be charged. I would be charged for soliciting for sex, which just feels...
That's outrageous.
I know. In 2024, when you work with a sex worker as freely as I've done, it doesn't feel like... We have this misconception that sex work is this, like, dark, seedy, back alley thing from, like, the 80s and, you know, really scary and seedy. And, yeah, sometimes it can be that. But a lot of us now that use sex workers... It's just, I wanted somebody to watch a TV show with me and blow me and then leave. Or like, you know, cuddle with me and tell me that I'm, you know, a good boy. Or, you know, spend time with me and just be there. And so if these lawmakers who probably are using sex workers already, whether they're saying it or not, would realize that, like, it's just another way to have your needs met, that would change things.
Are there sex workers who are specifically, like, really trained and qualified, you know, in their way to work with people with disabilities? Like, they really focus on working with people with disabilities?
There are. I have yet to meet them, but I know there's a woman out of Vancouver, Canada, named Trish, who runs Central Solutions. I'll give you her contact because you should speak with her. She runs a company specifically designed for sex workers to be trained in disabled bodies. And it's not sex work. It's like, you know, they call it body work and massage and whatever fun language they have to get around what it is. But it's allowing for disabled folks in Canada to have sex workers that are vetted and safe. The way that I do it is basically I go on this like male-to-male sex work site and I find someone that I think is attractive and I say, hey, have you ever been with a disabled guy before? And if they say no, I kind of get excited because I'm like, oh, that's really cool because I get to teach you from scratch what this is like, and that will help you later. The sex worker that I see now, we've been working together now for almost 7 years.
Wow. Oh,
amazing.
And like he's my friend. Like, I pay him. It's transactional, but we're friends now. Like, we have such a good rapport. Like, most of our sessions are come over, watch a marathon of Bob's Burgers, have some sex, and then go to sleep. Like, it's really, it's not this, like, hyper kinky, hyper sexualized experience. A lot of the time, because we only get touched by caregivers, and I'm predominantly touched by my caregivers, sometimes I want to just be touched by someone else. And so a lot of it isn't like this like big sexual experience. It's like, oh, I want somebody to cuddle with. I want somebody to touch me. I want to be able to touch somebody else. And I'm thankful for that. But there are moments where I wish that I didn't have to spend money to, you know, to have a sexual experience. Like, that can get really lonely too. And, you know, sometimes I oscillate between sex work is great and the only way that I get touched is if I pay for it. Like, that can be, that reality can be really hard to navigate sometimes.
You mentioned before about, you know, sometimes you want a sex worker or, you know, be with someone and they, you know, call you a good boy and then you get into it. I'm interested in like how your expression of kink or like power dynamics and how that world sort of blends in with your sexuality and your disability. And if you ever sort of merge the two, I'm sort of imagining, like, you know how we were talking about at the beginning, sort of, you know, having to educate people around being comfortable with you. Have you ever sort of tried to navigate that sort of through like the sexy dynamic play talk?
Yeah, I mean, with the first time I was with my sex worker, like he was so nervous and I was so nervous, and it took a few sessions for us to be comfy. But in terms of my kink, like, I like it when they tell me what to do. So they tell me to, like, you know, blow them or do whatever it is. I like to be told what to do, because in my model life, in my non-sex life, like, when I have a caregiver here, it's self-directed care, which means I have to know exactly what I'm doing all the time, and I have to direct it from the minute they get here to the minute they leave. And so when I get to be with somebody that I get to just be free, having them tell me what to do and not having to constantly coordinate can be really nice. And so I get off on being, you know, told what to do or being directed by someone else on what to do. And I like giving that power up a little bit in a safe, consensual way, because I don't want to always be directing. Of course, sometimes I have to, but most of the time I like to let go and I like to just be free in the moment. And if that means we have an orgasm, great. If that means one of us comes early, fine. Like, it's so much more, as I get older, it's so much more for me about the intimacy of the moment, because, you know, not to be morbid, but a lot of disabled folks, we don't know if we're going to live to 45 or 75 because of our disabilities. And so sometimes you have to really seize the moment and just enjoy and not worry so much about how it looks.
So that kind of like hedonism is driven a little bit by the mortality.
Yeah, which sounds kind of weird to say, but I've had a lot of disabled friends pass away because of their disabilities. So and I'd be lying if I said that didn't affect me somehow. So I try to just enjoy. And also, there's the death of, like, ability sometimes. Like, sometimes you're one day your body can do something, the next day it can't. So you have to take it as it is right now before you don't get to again.
So in terms of the body reacting differently, you talked before about enthusiastic consent and, you know, the gray areas around that and disability. How do you convey, just personally, how do you convey that consent? Because I imagine when a sex worker is coming in, they are so hyper aware that you feel completely comfortable and, you know, they're probably overly cautious. But in a situation where maybe you have that pre-existing dynamic where you've got like a little bit of like a power play type thing, how do you go about navigating that talk of consent?
My sex worker, and bless him, he's a great man. Hi, John, if you're listening. I'll say to him sometimes, because I'll get insecure and I'll say, like, am I, you know, good in bed? Because I know I really can't move and I can't really do much physically. Like, are you enjoying what we're doing? And he'll say, like, well, you know, you make good noises and you, like, I know that you're enjoying yourself and I get off on that. And then it's okay that you can't do certain things. And it's all right that, like, he's very reassuring in that, because, you know, even for me, I have this ableist fantasy of what queer sex is supposed to look like. And it doesn't involve my body. And so that's hard to take that idea of queer sexuality and transpose it onto a body that doesn't work the same way. So getting consent through, like, oh, we're kissing now, I'm going to moan for you. I'm going to make a noise. I'm going to let you know that this is all right. I'm going to say, you know, do it harder. I'm going to make sure you know somehow that I'm doing it. that you're doing something I enjoy. And so enthusiastic consent can look different than responses with your body. It can be what the person's saying or not saying. And I think when you're disabled, because every disabled body is different, you as the, if you're with a non-disabled partner or somebody with more ability, the person with more ability has to really look at the person they're with and be like, okay, are they comfortable? And, you know, we always say check in, but no, really check in and be like, are you all right? Is there pain? Like, I think check-ins can be really sexy when you're with, when it's done the right way.
What's your favorite way for check-ins? What's the sexiest check-in that you experienced?
The sexiest check-in. I was with a friend a couple months ago, and he was introducing me to asshole play, and I had not really done a lot of that before because I have IBS and I live with other disabilities that make the whole idea of ass play very terrifying for me. So he was like,
yep.
Well, let's just try. And so we were trying stuff. We were watching The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the Disney version. I don't know why that was on TV, but it was. We were watching it together, and like, we stopped halfway through with his finger up my ass to laugh at the stupid thing we were watching. And that was it was a funny way to be like, oh, you're still into this. Oh, it's okay. We're good. And like, so it wasn't the sexiest way to get enthusiastic consent, but it was really cute to like not think so much about what was happening below, but also be like, oh, this is a cute way to do this together.
There's always this narrative around like sex has to be like this perfectly scripted, like straight from a movie, super, super hot. Everything like looks straight out of a movie. And it's like sex can be really funny sometimes. Like,
and really that moment where the and weird and gross and smell like it, all those things are true. And I wish that we would embrace that more too.
Liam and I have been talking a lot recently sort of about the future of sex and relationships and AI and technology and like Apple Vision Pro. And I'm interested in like, you know, as a person with a disability, have you been sort of thinking about, you know, like we're moving into this future of sexuality where people are going to be like wearing these vision goggles and like, you know, watching this porn that's like so realistic and like really coming into your space. Do you like think about that in a way where that would be like really enhancing to sexuality for people with disability, or does that bring up other things? I'm just interested in where you're at with that.
I'm conflicted because part of me is like, part of why I don't watch a lot of porn and I don't watch a lot of those things. I see it all the time because I'm on gay Twitter and like every 5 seconds there's a dick in my face. And so like, I don't watch a lot of that or consume a lot of that, even though I've done queer porn with a disability, but I don't consume a lot of that because I want to touch the person I'm with. I want to experience them. I want them to experience me. And the idea of all of it being relegated to AI takes away the responsibility of the rest of society to like learn about the other person you're with. It's a mutual experience. And if we all are wearing our Apple Vision Pros, watching some pretend AI fucking, what are we learning about each other? Nothing. So like, I don't know. I think there are accessibility applications where it could be used, but I also feel like I prefer the old world way of like, oh, let's just muddle through this together in the moment and figure it out. That's more organic to me than watching, you know, the hottest guy in the world be in my face hole because I'm wearing an Apple Vision Pro. Like, I don't want porn sponsored by Meta. No, thank you.
Yeah, it's about the connection with the person, building something together, creating something in that moment for sure.
I'm interested in this gay Twitter. So I've never checked out gay Twitter before. What is gay Twitter like?
It's basically a bunch of white able-bodied muscle men being like, look, I have an OnlyFans. Like, it's pretty much that. And if you want to see like uncensored pictures of assholes, literally assholes, just type in gay Twitter like that. There you go. It's for the right there. Like, it's very Twitter, for all of Elon Musk's ridiculousness with it, and he's a trash fire and it needs to burn. But somehow porn on Twitter has lasted pretty well. And gay Twitter is basically just like, yeah, a bunch of able-bodied men promoting their OnlyFans to you. And like, it can be really jarring because I don't see my body represented. I don't see my experience represented. I've put my dick on there to be like, look, I'm disabled and I deserve to be here too. And like, it doesn't garner as much traction. And so it's really frustrating that even in digital spaces where you think accessibility would be more accessible. I'm still not seen the same way. And that's a shame.
And Andrew, I think you were saying earlier, you've been in some porn before. Am I correct?
Yeah, I was in a porn with my sex worker, John, about 5 years ago for Davey Wavy, the YouTuber. He has a porn studio now, Himeros.tv. He reached out to me and he said, hey, we want to recreate some porn from our site for our 2-year anniversary. Would you want to do one from your home? And I know how you, because he and I were friends, and he was like, I know how you want to, you know, show representation. Would you do one? And so I called up John and said, if I can get you paid, would you come like have sex with me like we do in our sessions on camera? And he was like, okay. And so he said yes, and I got him paid. And we spent about 3 hours before shooting. He came over and we talked about like, what do we want this thing to convey? And I said, I want people to see me making it in my wheelchair. I want them to see my wheelchair. I want them to see how you get me from my wheelchair to the bed. I want them to see you undress me to blow me. I want them to see all the things that my disability entails. I want it to be hot, but I also want it to be a how-to. Like, how do you fuck a hot disabled person? Here it is. And so I'm very proud of that. We made that about 5 years ago, and I haven't really done any big porn since, but it's something that I've been asked to have it used in educational panels around sex so that sex therapists can see, oh, here's how this looks. How do we talk about this?
Well, maybe we'll have to put that in the show notes if you're comfortable with us doing that.
Yeah, I think if you go on himeros.tv, I think you have to purchase it from their site because it's not mine. But you can definitely, I think it was called Brothers. Yeah, you can find it there, I think.
Yeah, and is that something that you want to explore more in the future?
Yes and no. I think it's important, but I also think that porn is creating and perpetuating this idea of sexuality that's not real. It's meant to be a bit of fantasy, and it's meant to be a big bit of play, which is important, but also sometimes really jarring when it's not at all what the experience is. So part of me does, like, if a big studio was like, we're going to pay you a couple thousand to like do another porn, I'd probably say sure, because I need the money right now. Poverty is fun. I'm not sure if I would do it again. It's really something that I have to think about.
Andrew, you have such a wealth of knowledge and such amazing experience. I really wish that, you know, sexual like educators in disability spaces could be connecting in more with you or people like you. I feel like it's just so important, especially just from a safety perspective, you know, hearing you talk about these early experiences that you had, you know, because it's like, of course, you're going to go and explore your sexuality anyway. You know, how you connected with the person and, you know, they brought you into your room and carried you and you just didn't, you know, you weren't really across the safety or how potentially dangerous that is. And I just feel like there has to be more people like you or yourself who's out there and educating in this way.
But also what we can do as people who aren't disabled to support disabled people, I think as well. Like what do you think is the most helpful thing in terms of that advocacy?
I think the biggest thing is all that education is important and we need that. And I think that needs to be there. But I think the first thing you do, the first step you take is look at that experience. And like I said earlier, both of you sitting here right now with me are going to be disabled one day if you're not dealing with disability or chronic illness already. And when you're an older disabled couple, you're probably still going to want to have intimacy together. How are you going to do that? What is that going to look like for you? What fears does that bring up for you? How does that make you feel when you think about that reality? I think all of us need to like confront that within ourselves first and be like, oh, wow, that's really fucking scary. Why am I afraid of that? Let me unpack that and then think and then go from there. And from there, once you kind of tap into that fear, then you can have an education piece around it.
Because there is also that, and I've certainly felt this, you know, with the disabled people that I know, that often I feel like I won't have an uncomfortable conversation because I'm too worried about upsetting them or maybe misspeaking and saying something that I didn't really mean, you know, and just kind of not deliberately misspeaking, but, you know, just the knowledge that that might happen. And I feel like so many important conversations haven't happened because I've been too afraid to have those conversations.
You know what? That fear is very, that fear is very real and very valid. I also think that disabled people have the opportunity to do it with grace. And I think a lot of disabled people are angry because they've been excluded. They're upset because they hear this stuff every other day. And I respect their anger, but I also think, like, you know what? We got to, if we're going to move this forward, we got to give some grace here. We got to let some people stumble and we got to allow them to try again. And so if we were hanging out and you did say something offensive, I would probably stop you and say, like, cool, you said this thing, where'd it come from? Explain to me, like I'm five, where this came from. And without shaming you, like, tell me why you thought that that was okay. And let me gently hold your hand and tell you why it's maybe not so okay. And so that's what I would do, because I think giving you that learning block is more important than being like, you're an ableist. Oh my God. No. Like, I could do that all day, but that's not going to help me or you.
Yeah. And absolutely. Like, that's something that can be taken into all, you know, conversations.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there's so much hesitancy at the moment to have conversations where everyone's worried about upsetting people. You know, it's so important to, and you know, it's such a beautiful example that you're putting out there by saying, I'm going to have the grace to know that someone might make a mistake and that's going to be all right. We can actually arrive at a better place together in a way that we both respect each other.
I mean, not to be flipping here, but let's come together to a better place, and so, like, I think, you know, I haven't always had the grace, and I don't always have the grace, but I try to understand that they're learning, and it's disability when you have no experience with it or limited experience with it is a learning curve. And if I can build that bridge for you, that's more important to me than anything else.
And you're also doing such an incredible job. And for our listeners, I do implore you to check out your podcast, Disability After Dark, because there are so many incredible conversations with people with lots of different disabilities. And you're doing such a great work in showcasing how to have beautiful and honest conversations.
Oh, yeah. I'm very proud of it. We're in our eighth year now, which feels like,
wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Our eighth year. And by R, I mean myself and I in my bedroom making a show. and, you know, it went from a sexuality show to a disability everything show. Because after about 150 episodes of sex, I was like, I'm really bored now. I have no idea what to do. What do I do? And I just pivoted to make it stories, because I wanted a podcast where every week disability was on the table and we were talking about it.
And platforming just sex positive culture across all walks of life, across all, you know, disability, able bodies. It's so important that we move in a sex positive direction.
Not all walks of life, because some of us don't do that, but
okay. So Andrew, thank you so much for bringing your voice to this conversation and joining us on the podcast.
Well, it's such a pleasure. Thank you for waking up early and talking to me. It was such a good time.
Oh,
so worth it. It's been amazing to talk with you.
Anytime. And we hope to find ourselves in Canada sometime as well, so we can all catch up and have
I would like to extend a digital invitation to you both. Sometimes I have non-disabled folks on the show and I allow them to just ask questions and I allow them to just talk to me freely about questions they have. So if ever you want to do that, you're more than welcome.
Oh, we would love to.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
And for people who want to check out, well, obviously we've mentioned your incredible podcast, but is there any other plugs that you would like to make?
Yeah, you can go to andrewgrizza.com. You can hire me to consult, to speak, to edit, to do. I do freelancing, everything around disability. You can also, I'm working on a book. It should be out.
Oh, amazing.
I'm hopefully we'll finish it, the first manuscript, this summer. Hopefully it'll be out by the fall. I don't know. I can't say because I don't know yet, but it's coming out. It's tentatively called Notes from a Queer Cripple, and it's all about my experience navigating sexuality and trying to be sexual and all those things.
Incredible. Oh. Well, when that comes out, you'll have to come back on the podcast as well, because
we'd love to
talk to you about that.
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to the Evolving Love podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback and support fuels our passion And together, we're building a community of curiosity, kindness, and growth.
If you would like to show your support and are interested in accessing 2 extra podcast episodes each month, along with access to my exclusive writing, you can become a premium subscriber over at evolvingloveproject.substack.com. Subscribe, comment, and let's keep the conversation going.